Okay, a few announcements. I sent out an email indicating that the first homework is out. It's due. I extended it by a day because some problem sending the announcement on the mailing list. So it's due on Friday. Okay. Submission, I decided for just to try this out to have online web-based submissions through Spark. Does anyone here use Spark? A few of you have to submit homeworks. Okay, so you know how it was. I actually don't. I'm learning how to create a homework. So I actually went and created a homework in there. Log in and make sure you can actually upload. If there's a problem, let me know because I am not used to it. Okay, so I'm assuming that it worked because it shows homework one. And if there's any problem or any settings that I need to tweak, do let me know. Okay. So we will, if this works, then we'll continue with it. If there's any problem, we'll see what to do. Okay. So keep that in mind and email me if you see any problems with the online submission. So what I'm going to do today, coming back to the lecture, is to talk about virtualization. Okay. This material that was left over from last time, but there is enough of it that we'll probably end up spending much of the class on this. Okay. So let's start with the introduction to what is virtualization and why do we need it. So here's a definition of what we will mean by virtualization. Okay, virtualization essentially allows you to extend or replace an existing interface, okay, to mimic the behavior of another system. Okay, here's an example of what we mean by this statement. So let's assume that there is a certain system, there's a certain hardware or a certain software, we'll call it system A. Okay? It exposes a certain interface to its applications. Typically these are the APIs or the system call interface or what have you. Okay? Now here you have a system B which may have a different hardware or a different OS software or both. Okay? Different hardware platform, potentially different software platform or both. And the interface that it exposes to its application we'll call interface B. This is a different interface, okay, from interface A. Okay. Now if you want to take the applications that were running on system A and you want to run them on B, they are not going to run as is, okay, because either the hardware has changed, the instruction set has changed, or the platform has changed. This may be a different OS altogether. But if you still wanted to run that application without any modifications, what you now need is a layer that sits between interface B and the program. And what this layer does is it mimics the behavior of system A in software. Okay, that's what this layer is doing. So you are implementing the mimicking of A on B, and what this layer does is it exposes as interface A back to the application. Okay? So as far as the application is concerned, when it runs on this machine, okay, it basically sees interface A and it thinks it is running on the same hardware as before, but it's actually not. It's running on a different platform altogether, and this layer, which we call the virtualization layer, essentially exposes a virtual abstraction of a different software or a hardware platform. Okay, that in essence or in a nutshell is what virtualization allows you to do. Okay, are there any questions on this concept of what is virtualization? It's essentially mimicking the interface, so either extending or replacing an interface to mimic the behavior of another system. So why was this needed? So this was introduced back in the 70s, okay, by IBM in particular. So IBM had this mainframe line of machines, and every few years they would come up with a new architecture. Okay, their processor sets would change, their operating system would change, the interface would change. And that would, the enhancements would be in some sense better than the previous generation of mainframe. Okay? But if you look at this from a standpoint of a customer, okay, the customer has purchased a previous generation of machine and has invested a lot of effort and money in developing applications that run on that machine, and then you say, okay, you upgrade the hardware, but by the way, you now have to rewrite all your applications because it doesn't run, because the instruction set has changed or the OS interface has changed, so everything has changed, so it doesn't work. You have to port it or rewrite it. Okay? From a standpoint of a customer, that's a big transition cost. Okay? You would rather not spend effort rewriting things that are already running. Right? You want them to run as is. Okay? And the only way to keep it as is, you don't change the hardware instruction set and don't change the operating system. But then there is no evolution. Yeah, things can only get faster but not better. Okay? So if you want to get things get faster and better, then there is going to be some disruption. And to avoid this disruption, what they did is they introduced new generations of machines. But they said, we'll give you this software layer that will emulate what the previous generation looked like. So if you have old applications, run them in this on the software layer and they'll run unmodified. Okay, but if you write new applications, write them to interface B and take advantages of the new features that is presented to you by system B. So over time, you can then write new application or port existing application, but on day one you can basically take all of the applications that were running on the previous generation and run them using this virtualization layer without having to modify anything. So that was the rationale for introducing virtualization. So it's an old technology. It's been around for decades, but it's now again become popular for different set of reasons. Yeah, this is basically how virtualization techniques were invented back in the 70s. And why they were useful then, some of those rationales still holds, but there are other reasons. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So basically what you want to do is handle platform diversity by running applications or program inside virtual machines, and virtual machines are basically an abstraction that this virtualization layer provides to applications that run on top of it. Okay. So this gives you portability. You can run applications on different hardware, okay, and it gives you flexibility. You don't have to modify applications. Okay, so this is what I presented here as a very general definition. Okay, you are basically replacing an interface to mimic the behavior of another system. What interface can we actually replace? Okay, so what this next slide shows you is basically there are different types of interfaces and you can mimic different ones. Okay, so if what at the hardware level you have the interface of instructions, okay, assembly instructions. At the operating system level, the interface that you provide above it is that of system calls. Okay? And at the application, then there is a library that sits in between. So you can, applications basically talk to the OS using library function. So there are three different interfaces one can think of mimicking. Okay? There are instruction sets, there are system calls, and there are library functions. And depending on where the virtualization layer sits and what interface it is actually mimicking, you get different types of virtualization. Okay. At the lowest level, you can get hardware virtualization if the virtualization mimics some other instruction set and it sits on a particular set of hardware. Okay. So if this is where the virtualization layer resides, you have hardware level virtualization. So it can expose a different machine. If it sits here, okay, it's basically mimicking a different set of system calls, you get OS level virtualization. So here you can use one platform that exposes system call interface of some other platform. Okay. And you can have library functions, so you have libraries that you mimic some others. So you can do this at the application level. So that's referred to as application level virtualization. So virtualization can be implemented at these different layers, hardware, operating system at the application level. Okay. We are mostly going to talk about hardware virtualization today, but I'll keep referring to OS and application level virtualization as well. Okay. Yes, there are questions.
Well, if you have the bottom level of hardware virtualization, then you get all the other levels. Because if you have the hardware virtualization, you can install the other operating system on it, you can install the libraries on it.
Yeah. Question is, if you have hardware level virtualization, don't you get other things? Because on this hardware, you can implement a different operating system and different library. Indeed, you do get all of those features. So then question is, why would you need virtualization at other layers? Yeah, performance. Why would you get better performance by virtualizing at a different layer?
Because then the operating system can talk directly to the hardware, whereas before it has to talk to the virtual hardware, which then talk to the hardware.
Okay. There was some other hand somewhere. Anyone has anything else to add?
Ease of programming.
In what sense is the programming eased by implementing?
More than assembly instructions, it's easier to program
in
a higher level language.
Yes.
Shipping software is easier.
Yeah. So now, indeed, it's always easier to program in higher level languages than assembly instruction. But what virtualization, what hardware virtualization gives is mimicking instructions. That doesn't mean applications have to be written at assembly level. You can still write an application in C, C++, Java. Compiler will do the translation, generate assembly code and binary instructions. So doesn't mean that just because your hardware level virtualization, all apps have to be written in assembly. Okay, just mimicking an interface, applications are written as they are. Okay. So coming back to this, we will see that there is indeed depending on where you put this, the overhead of virtualization is different, and that also has performance implication. Okay, so if you implement it here, then as a new operating system has to run on top, and then that adds some overhead. If you implement virtualization at the OS level, okay, then there are different performance implication. And as we go and talk about these different layers and various types of virtualization, this will become clear. Okay, so let's come back to this. Where do you want to virtualize? Okay, that question later. Okay, but is this clear? So you can, there are different types of interfaces, assembly instructions, system calls, library APIs, and depending on where you implement this layer, you get different forms of virtualization. Okay. So now let's talk about virtualization, different types of virtualization. Okay, so first what we have is what is called emulation. Okay, here the virtual machine, or the by VM we mean a virtual machine or the virtualization layer, it emulates or simulates complete hardware. Okay, so what emulation does is this software layer emulates an entire set of hardware, including the instruction set, including all the hardware devices. Everything is emulated in software. So this is like a software PC or a software machine. Okay. So what emulation allows you to do is you can take any hardware and emulate any other hardware on top of it. Okay. So what this emulation software runs on is independent of what it is trying to emulate. Okay. In other words, this picture that I showed you initially. So this could be an emulation layer. Okay, because this could be a completely different hardware, okay, and it's emulating a different. So for instance, you can have x86 instructions being emulated on PowerPC architecture. Okay, so now you can run x86 applications, Windows applications or Linux applications that are compiled on x86, use this emulation layer, and they'll run on a completely different hardware altogether. Could be a PowerPC or whatever else it is. So now what happens at the emulation layer is every instruction needs to be emulated. Okay. So if you have, let's say, assembly instructions that do add or move, so this could be x86 instructions that are running on an x86 program, and this emulation layer has to look at each instruction and say what is the equivalent instruction on this other architecture, let's say the PowerPC architecture, and then fire off that instruction to be actually executed. Okay. So this is instruction by instruction emulation. So you look at what is this program doing, what instruction is it trying to emulate, execute, and what's the equivalent things. So this could not be one but multiple instructions that I run on the native hardware to emulate the effect of that instruction. Okay. Is that clear? What's happening? Yes, there's a question.
Can you do like a just-in-time compile from x86 to PowerPC? Like kind of like what Java does with its virtual machines?
Right, so there's a question of just-in-time compiler. We'll come to application level virtualization separately. Okay, so that's what. So yes, so we'll come to those things in just next slide. So I'm just talking about emulation now. So this is how emulation would work. There are multiple ways to do virtualization. So what you're talking about is done at the application level. Okay, so now, so here you can. So what does means is basically you can emulate any instruction set using any other instruction set. So for each instruction, you have a corresponding set of instructions on a native hardware that you should execute. So you trap each, not trap, but you look at each instruction and say, to do this, I need to do these other instructions on my native hardware. And I get the same effect. Okay? So in effect, you are doing translation at runtime, not at compile time, by looking at what is this instruction and translating it to a native language, which is your native assembly instruction set. Okay. There are many of these available. Box is and QEMU are two open source projects that implement emulation. Okay. So if you actually have any Linux desktop or a Linux server, you can get this Box hardware. It allows you to run Windows, for instance. You can run Windows on Linux or some other platform on Linux, just as an example of what you can do with you. If you had PowerPC versions of Mac or you encountered them, there was this piece of software called Virtual PC for the Mac. Okay, this allowed you to run. What it did is it emulated x86 on PowerPC. Okay, so you could, for instance, run Windows on PowerPC machines, on Mac OS. This is what it allowed you to do. It was doing this translation at runtime. So you will get a performance hit, okay, because these instructions are not running at native speed; they are being translated. Okay, so that there's going to be a performance degradation, no question. But the advantage is you can run applications that were designed for to run on some other hardware on a different set of on a different machine. Okay, that's emulation. So the next level of virtualization we'll talk about is what is called full or native virtualization. Okay. So what this does, okay, effectively what this is doing is it's emulating the same hardware on a given hardware, okay, not a different hardware. So you are emulating the same instruction set. Okay. So in other words, in this previous picture, what is, so you have type interface B, there is a virtualization layer. What is exposed to the application is also the same interface. So interface B is exposed to the application using interface B. Question is, why would you want to do it? Why do you want to mimic the same instructions or same API on the same hardware? So here you are emulating some other instructions. Okay, if you are doing hardware level virtualization, here you are doing using the same, exposing the same hardware abstraction, same instructions.
So like testing some OS development that you have done and you don't want to perfect running operating system, so providing an environment.
Okay, for testing and development, you have something to add?
You could have two operating systems running at the same time, and you can switch between the two.
Yes. So the reason to do this is not the same reason why what I showed you on the first slide, which is I want portability. The reason to do this is to share resources on your hardware in a different way. Okay. There are two examples that were just given. One was you can run two operating systems on the machine at the same time. And that is indeed true. What you can get using native virtualization is you have hardware. Okay. You can actually run two virtual machines at the same time and each is running its own OS. So you can run this concurrently. So you can actually run have Linux and Windows or Linux or another Linux or anything else running at the same time. Okay. So in other words, your single physical machine can run two operating systems, two a full software stack. So it looks like two, you are running two machines on a single machine. So it's better use of resources. So if you have, let's say, a two core CPU or a four core CPU, okay, there are four processors. If you are just running one OS, maybe it doesn't need all of those resources. So how do I make better use of what hardware I already have? Can run another machine. Okay. Adjacent to this one. Okay. Now the reason, so you're basic, because you're emulating the same hardware, this just looks like a sliced version of this hardware inside this virtual machine. In other words, this looks like a subset of the resources you have on the physical machine. Okay. The other example that was given was OS development. Suppose you are a kernel developer. Okay. You wrote some kernel code. Okay. And you compile kernel, you booted it. Okay, there was a bug, kernel crashed. Okay. Now doing this on actual hardware is very painful. Okay, because as soon as it crashes, then you have to, you may go and corrupt the hardware, corrupt the disk. Your OS crash, it tried to write something out, your disk is corrupt. Now you have to go and reinstall the whole OS, okay, and then recompile it and try to figure out what happened. From a kernel developer standpoint, this takes one small bug, can waste hours of development time because all you're doing is scrubbing the disk, reinstalling the thing because this OS that crashed took the disk down with it. Okay? If you run things inside virtual machine, you get lot of advantages. Okay? So you can actually take snapshots, as you will see in a later class. You can take snapshots of the disk. So you can actually roll back to a previous state. Because everything is virtualized and the state, you can go back to previous state and restore from a clean state. Okay? You can actually, it's much easier to debug kernels using virtual machines than it is if you actually have kernels running on hardware. Okay? You can run your kernel inside a debugger. Okay? Because you have much greater control over how the OS is running on a virtual machine. It's a software artifact. It's not real hardware. So you can slow it down. You can pause it at any given point in time and see what is happening on the machine. You cannot pause real hardware. That just doesn't happen. But here you can actually pause a virtual machine at any point, because it's just a software, piece of software. You say pause, it just stops running. And then you can examine its state. Okay. So a lot of advantages that you will not get otherwise you can get using native virtualization. Okay. Any questions here? Okay. So what the way you now it goes without saying that full or native virtualization is going to be a lot more efficient than emulation. Okay. In emulation, every instruction had to be translated. Okay. In full and native virtualization, because you are emulating the same hardware, okay, you don't do any translation. You actually run that instruction natively. Okay, because if you want to do add, there's nothing to translate. You will just take the add and you will execute it on the CPU. Okay. So this is going to be much faster than emulation. Okay, is that clear? So performance, you will not get a performance hit as you did in case of emulation. Okay. And there are many products that do this. If you have VMware Workstation or Parallels, that actually does some notion of full native virtualization. IBM's VM family also does the same thing. Okay. So there is yet another type of virtualization called para-virtualization. Okay. And I'll talk about this in the next few slides again, but just to give you what the concept is, in para-virtualization, the virtual machine does not emulate any hardware. Okay. Instead, virtualization is done differently. What happens is the operating system that is running inside a para-virtualized VM is actually modified. Okay, and you use the special API that the VM is supposed to expose is embedded inside the operating system. So you actually go and modify the OS. Okay. And the whatever interface you wanted to export, you actually embed it in the OS by having the OS make some special calls. Okay. We'll see why that is needed in a moment. Okay. These calls are called hyper calls. Okay. They're similar to system calls used by the operating system. Hyper calls are the interface that a hypervisor or the virtualization layer exports to you. So you modify the OS and you embed hyper calls in the OS. So OS makes hyper calls to the hypervisor. Hypervisor does whatever the OS wanted it to do. Okay. Unlike the previous two types of virtualization, here the whatever is running inside the VM is not unmodified. Okay. In emulation and native virtualization, you can take unmodified code, run it on the virtual machine, and things work just fine. Here you are actually modifying the OS. You don't have to modify applications, okay, but you do have to modify the OS. Okay. We'll see that this is also efficient. Yeah, because there are certain advantage you get by using para-virtualization. We will come back to this when I talk about different types of hypervisors in a moment. Okay. Xen, which is an open source virtual machine platform, uses para-virtualization, and VMware's ESX server also uses para-virtualization. Okay. So these three things that I just talked about, they are all hardware level virtualization techniques. Okay. The next one we'll talk about is what's called OS level virtualization. Okay. So here the OS allows multiple secure virtual servers to be run on top. Okay. In this case, the guest OS is the same as the host OS, but just appears isolated. Okay. You are not running a new version of the operating system inside this virtual machine. It's the same kernel as one that's running on the OS. The application just get the abstraction of being isolated from others. Yeah, so let me show you an example of how OS level virtualization works. Okay. Linux, vServers, BSD, JL, Solaris containers, they all do OS level virtualization, okay, if you know about any of these. Yeah, so you have hardware, you have OS. The virtualization layer actually is now embedded in the OS. Okay. So if you do OS level virtualization, what you get, this is VM, another VM. So it's just a software abstraction. So it looks like you have two VMs that are running on the same OS. So here is apps. Okay. The OS that's running on this VM is the same as the actual OS on the machine. The OS running here is also the same. The only advantage of doing OS level virtualization, it gives you physical isolation. Whatever apps are running here cannot see these apps, and whatever apps are running here cannot see those apps. Okay. And then you can also take the resources on the underlying machine and partition them. You can say that this VM gets 2 gigabytes of RAM and this one gets the other 2 if there are 4 GB. So you have partitioned the resources across the virtual machine. You can also partition the CPU, saying if there's one CPU, this guy gets, let's say, 60% of the CPU, this gets 40%. Okay. And this OSL virtualization will allow you to do this slicing. Okay. So it just gives you an abstraction of these apps and this OS being isolated from the other one. Okay. That is one advantage of doing OS level virtualization. Now Solaris, in addition, because you can mimic some other interfaces, also allows you to do other things. Okay. When you create a Solaris container, okay, it also allows you to say emulate which version of Solaris. Okay. So if this is running Solaris OS X 10, or not OS X, OS 10, Solaris 10, you can say create a virtual machine and make it appear like it's running Solaris 9.5. So then the system call interface that these applications see looks like exactly the system call interface of this older generation of Solaris. Okay. Again, the advantage of doing this is if you implemented an app using Solaris 9.5 and they made some tweaks to the OS in system call interface or change some semantics, you do not have to change anything. You just create a virtual machine and say make it look like whatever apps are running there, provide them the same environment as Solaris 9.5, Solaris 8, and then it will get that abstraction. So applications will again run unmodified. So you get two advantages. One advantage is you get resource partitioning across VM. So if this application is misbehaving or hangs, it does not impact what's happening inside this VM. Okay. And vice versa. So you get all this partitioning benefit. Second thing is you can emulate different OS level APIs, okay, so rather OS level system call interfaces. So in other words, you can emulate the interface that was exposed by a different version of that kernel. Okay. You could also emulate some other kernel API altogether. Okay, that's also possible. Okay, but most of the ones that you use are actually only trying to provide other versions of a previous generation of that kernel rather than some other kernel. Okay. Is this clear? What OS level virtualization does? Okay, the last one we talked about is application level virtualization. Here you are implementing virtualization at the application level. Okay. Simplest example of this is what Java does, okay, using Java virtual machine. Okay. So any Java application, okay, gets the abstraction of a virtual machine. Okay, that's the Java abstract, Java virtual machine. Okay. And the JVM itself runs on a physical hardware. Okay. Now if you write Java applications once, so long as you have the JVM interface, it runs on any platform. Okay, because the JVM abstraction is independent of the physical hardware abstraction. The Java code will run on Windows, Linux, Solaris, other hardware architectures, doesn't matter. Okay. Same advantage that virtualization gave you. Okay. This is what Java does. But at the application level. Okay. There are other, so that's an example. Okay. There are other types of virtualization. So you have this Rosetta piece of software called Rosetta on a Mac. Okay. Because Apple actually shifted from PowerPC architecture to Intel architectures a few years back. Okay. They wanted a way to continue to run PowerPC applications on newer hardware. Okay. And to do this, they implemented licensed this technology called Rosetta, which does dynamic translation. It actually does emulation, but at the application level. Okay, so we already talked about emulation. So what Rosetta does is basically exposes a PowerPC instruction set to the application, and it dynamically translates whatever a PowerPC application does into x86 instruction on the fly. So then now you can take your old applications that you develop for a Mac platform, their PowerPC, you don't have to recompile them, you can just run them on an x86 machine. Okay. So what Rosetta will do is every time this thing starts executing a PowerPC, it will execute the equivalent or the set or equivalent set of x86 instructions on the fly. So your application runs unmodified. Okay, this is not done at the application level. So you don't even see this. It's happening in the background. Whenever you start a PowerPC app on an Intel machine, Rosetta just starts running and it does the translation transparently. Okay, so it's all done in a nice way to allow portability. Okay, and JVM is the other example. It also gives you portability for the same reason, because it is basically exposing a abstract JVM interface that remains unchanged, independent of the platform. Any questions on various types of virtualization? Okay, so what I want to do next is actually talk about full native and para virtualization. Okay, and so to do that, we will have to understand what a hypervisor is, how it actually works. Okay, so hypervisor is basically your virtualization layer. Okay, so that's what. So also called a virtual machine monitor or a VMM. Okay, virtual machines run on top of the hypervisor. Okay, and there are two types of hypervisors. It's called a type 1 hypervisor and a type 2 hypervisor. Typically a type 1 hypervisor runs on bare metal. Okay, that's shown here. So you have hardware. Your type 1 hypervisor is the software layer that's running on the hardware. Okay, it is basically sitting between the hardware and anything that runs above it. Okay, on top of type 1 hypervisor, you have virtual machines. Okay, so here you are shown two virtual machines. One virtual machine is running the Windows OS and Windows apps. Another virtual machine here is running the Linux OS and Linux apps. Okay, you can have as many of these as you want. Okay, and these virtual machines share the underlying hardware. Okay, the hardware is partitioned or multiplexed, is probably the more accurate term, multiplexed across these virtual machines. Okay, this is type 1 hypervisor. Okay, type 1 hypervisor typically run on servers. Right, if you run desktops and you have played with any virtualization, typically that wouldn't be a type 1 hypervisor. Okay, if you use VMware, for example, you are actually using what's called a type 2 hypervisor. Okay, type 2 hypervisor runs on what is called a host OS. It doesn't run on bare metal. Okay, you have a machine and you boot your normal OS on that machine. And on that machine, then you will run a hypervisor. Okay, this is called a type 2 hypervisor. Okay, so you have your normal apps running. So you might have a Mac or a Windows. You're just running Windows, let's say host operating system. You run your typical apps. And then you start VMware. So VMware, in this case, in VMware workstation, would be a type 2 hypervisor. Okay. On this type 2 hypervisor also, you can create virtual machines, more than one, if you want. And in each virtual machine, you can run what is called a guest OS. Okay. So here you have host OS, there's a guest OS. Okay. So one OS is running on another, top of another OS. Okay. And in this guest OS, you can run processes for applications. In both cases, the hypervisor is doing whatever we said it would do. It's taking one interface and emulating some other interface. In this case, it's emulating the same one, okay? But it is doing the mimicking. Okay? And both of them provide the abstraction of a full machine. Okay? Virtual machine just looks like a normal PC. In this case, or a normal server, it has a CPU, it has memory, it has disk. They're all virtual devices, not real devices. It's a virtual CPU, it's an emulated CPU or a logical CPU, virtual disks, virtual memory. Okay, yes, question there.
How does this hypervisor distribute processes between the host OS and the guest OS? Doesn't the host operating system get to choose how much processing power the hypervisor gets?
Yes. Type 2 hypervisor, as far as the host OS is concerned, is a normal process. Okay. This thing just looks at this as a normal application. It doesn't even know that's a hypervisor. So in this case, hypervisor runs as a guest, a normal user level process. Okay? So the OS is just, so this is one, this may be Firefox, this may be Word, this just looks like another process in your system. It doesn't, as far as the OS is concerned, it doesn't know, it doesn't care. Okay? All of the work is done here. We'll talk about how this is done.
So how does the type 2 hypervisor distribute hardware resources?
So the type 2 hypervisor is not distributing hardware resources. The OS is multiplexing resources. The host OS is multiplexing resources exactly the way it would. Okay? Even if you didn't have this, if you had just these two processes, the OS is multiplexing the hardware across this. It's context switching between CPUs, it's giving certain amount of memory to each of them and so on and so forth. It just treats this the same way. Okay? It gets some share of the CPU, it gets some part of memory. It's exactly the same. Okay. And whatever is inside the guest OS is not even visible to the host OS. It only sees this as a process. This process is actually running another kernel and a set of processes. These are not even visible here. Okay. These might just run as threads or something that the OS is not aware of. Okay, is this clear? Yes. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about all of this. Just how is it implemented? That's the next slide. Okay. So before we even understand this type 1 and type 2 in more detail, we need to understand how you would actually go about writing a type 1 hypervisor. What hardware level support do you even need to implement a type 1 hypervisor? Okay. So to understand this, you need to know something about hardware. Okay. And this is what is said here. So typically, any CPU, any processor that you get, okay, has multiple protection rings. Okay. Or what? So typically, there will be at least two: a user mode and a kernel mode. Okay. As the name suggests, all user-level processes run in user mode, okay, also called ring 3 in x86 terminology. Okay. Kernels will run in kernel mode, okay, also called ring 0. Okay. Now, what's the difference between these modes? So the only difference is in user mode, there are certain assembly instructions you are not allowed to execute. Those are called privileged instructions. Those can only be executed by the kernel in kernel mode. Okay? So set of instructions that can be only executed in kernel mode are called privileged instructions, or rather sensitive instructions, not privileged. So what are sensitive instructions? This could be any I/O request. It would be changing the page table settings, anything that requires OS intervention. You don't want application to muck around with low level hardware stuff like changing page table settings or doing I/O, directly talking to I/O devices. All this is done by the OS on behalf of applications. Okay? And there are special instructions in the instruction set that allow you to do this, and only the kernel can run them. And the way you only allow the kernel to run them is you have these two modes. If you are running in user mode, these instructions are not available to you. You cannot execute them. If you execute them, you will basically crash. Okay, if you write a user level program with any of sensitive instruction and try to run them, because you are running in user mode, the hardware will prevent you from executing it. Your process will be terminated. Only the kernel can run it. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So those are called sensitive instruction. And then there's another set of instructions in your instruction set. These are called privileged instructions. Privileged instructions are the ones that cause a trap. Okay, so you try to execute something. This will cause a trap and it will cause you to go into kernel mode. Okay. Typically, when you make a system call, you execute a privileged instruction. This causes a trap and then the kernel starts executing and it will actually execute the system call for you. Okay? So there are these two classes of instructions. Now here is an important insight. Okay? The insight is that type 1 virtualization is feasible only if sensitive instructions are a subset of the privileged instructions. Okay? What does this mean? Let's try to understand what type 1 virtualization means. Okay, let's go back to this picture. Okay? Here you have a hardware. Okay? Here's your type 1 hypervisor. Type 1 hypervisor is a privileged piece of software. Okay? So instead of running a normal kernel on this machine, you will run the type 1 hypervisor in kernel mode. Okay? This is the thing that's running in ring 0. Okay? So on top of this, you have virtual machines. Okay? And here are operating systems kernels that are also running. Okay? Question is, what mode should this kernel run in? This is running in ring 0, privileged mode. What mode should this run in? User mode or kernel mode? It's a kernel. Okay, it's not a... Okay, it has to run in kernel mode. Why? And what does it give you?
Because it doesn't always according to the user. It has to run kernel application, kernel level threads. So it has to work in kernel.
Okay. So this is a kernel. It is going to execute privileged instructions from time to time for its processes. Okay. So the claim is it should run in kernel mode. Okay. You have something to add?
Then you could have conflicts if both of those two operating systems are running in kernel mode. You need just the type 1 hypervisor running in kernel mode, and for the two other kernels to run in user mode, and to call the type 1 hypervisor, they can manage and make sure they're not conflicting with each other.
Okay. So a different point. So first point was this kernel is going to execute kernel privileged instructions, sensitive instructions. So it has to run in kernel mode. As against this, now you have the other issue that there are multiple kernels running here. Okay? This kernel doesn't even know about the existence of that kernel. So if this one runs in kernel mode and that one runs in kernel mode, you get full access to the hardware. Okay? In particular, there may be memory allocated to this VM that this virtual machine now has access to, in particular that kernel has access to. Okay? So it can do malicious things, it can do things inadvertently and go and destroy things that doesn't even belong to it. Okay? So there is this inherent conflict where you have multiple kernels running and kernels don't know about each other and may not trust each other. Okay? So you don't want this kernel to get access to anything that belongs to that VM and vice versa. If you run in kernel mode, you will get access to it. Okay. So you have this conflict. If you don't run in kernel mode, you cannot execute kernel level instructions. And if you run in kernel mode, you have gotten access to things you shouldn't get access to. So what should you do?
Isn't hypervisor monitoring everything? So even if both run in kernel mode, you still have another layer of control before it goes to the
handler. Right. So question is, isn't the hypervisor monitoring everything? Hypervisor is indeed monitoring everything, but if these run in kernel mode, you are no more powerful than anything that's running here. So you can't preempt it, you cannot do anything. You are running at the same level of priority, quote unquote, as the hardware.
So if both of them run on the kernel mode, how does
it come to this? No, so we haven't resolved the question. I'm still asking, what should you run in kernel mode or user mode? Okay. So it should be clear that for safety reasons, these kernels should not run in kernel mode, what we call ring zero, because you are actually violating the first and foremost principle, saying this is a virtual machine that's isolated from that virtual machine. You cannot just give access to this kernel and say you can now muck around with that VM's memory or look at what's happening there and so on. That is just not possible. Okay? So that by itself suggests that regardless of the fact that you are running kernel level instruction, you shouldn't get kernel level access on the underlying hardware. Okay? Yes, you have something to say.
So you should just have a user mode to try to access sensitive instruction. It's like an interrupt in the type of hypervisor.
Yeah. So I'll come to that in just a second, what you just said. So first point is only type 1 hypervisor is trusted, only it gets to run in kernel mode. Now it can control access to the entire hardware because all these are not going to run in kernel mode. It can figure out when this runs and when that runs and prevent this guy from accessing that guy's memory and whatnot. Okay. So type 1 hypervisor runs in kernel mode. So what does this mean? This kernel is not running in kernel mode. In particular, it's going to run in user mode. Okay? Now if it runs in user mode, then you have a problem. Because if it tries to execute a sensitive instruction to the hardware, this looks like a user level process that is trying to do something it shouldn't do. Okay? Typical hardware thing is just terminate the process. But you don't want that. You don't want this OS to crash because it tried to do what it was supposed to do. Execute a sensitive instruction. Okay. So what should the answer be?
Okay.
Right. So the only thing you can do is if this tries to execute a privileged sensitive instruction, you should cause a trap that tells the hypervisor, I want to do something privileged, but I do not have the privileges to do it. I'm not running in kernel mode. You do it for me. Okay. This is exactly what happens when you do a system call. If you are just a normal kernel and a process does not have direct access to the low-level hardware because you want to protect the low-level hardware. So the kernel, only the kernel has access to the low-level hardware. So if the OS process wants to access a file, it will trigger a system call and the OS, there will be a trap and the OS will go access the file for you and return it. Same thing is happening here. Okay? So OS wants to do something which is not allowed to do, but it needs to cause a trap. Okay? And then the type 1 hypervisor should be able to execute that on your behalf. Okay? Now that is where the result comes in. Okay? It says that type 1 virtualization is feasible only if the sensitive instructions are a subset of privilege instructions. Privilege instructions are the one that cause a trap by definition. Okay? And if your sensitive instructions are a subset of privilege instructions, sensitive instructions will also cause a trap. Okay? That's exactly what you want. Okay? You don't want the hardware to terminate the process. You want the hardware to raise a trap and go into privileged mode and let the privileged software decide what to do, okay? Whether to terminate the process or execute the instruction on behalf of the process. Okay? Is this clear where this result is coming from? If the sensitive instructions do not cause a trap, then nothing is going to work because you will not be able to trap to the hypervisor. Okay. Now it so happens that x86 actually ignores sensitive instructions in user mode. If you try to execute it, does nothing, it does not cause a trap. Okay. So basically what this says is vanilla x86 hardware actually cannot support type 1 virtualization. Okay, so if you actually take type 1 hypervisors and you take any old generation Intel machines, it doesn't run. Okay, because you do not have this feature supported. You have sensitive instructions, you have privileged instructions, but one is not a subset of the other. Okay? Sensitive instruction in particular don't cause a trap. Okay? So if you are a kernel and you try to implement, execute a sensitive instruction, ignore. Okay? No trap. So nothing is going to work. Okay? So to enable type 1 support on x86 hardware, there has been some enhancements made to the hardware. Okay? In particular, Intel has this VT technology, virtualization technology, that they've added. Okay? And AMD has this SVM technology that they've added. Okay? When you turn on this feature, they are only available on modern processors. Older processors don't have this support. You turn it on, then you basically get this property. Okay? By turning it on, you can tell the hardware, say, if this instruction is executed, cause a trap. In particular, it is actually even more flexible. Okay. What you can do is, once you create containers where virtual machines can run, you can specify a bit vector. Okay. For every instruction, you have a bit, which is 0 or 1. Okay. If you set the bit, it says if this instruction is executed in user mode, create a trap. If the bit is 0, it says if this instruction is executed, do nothing. I mean, just execute if you have the privileges, if not, just ignore it. Okay. So by default, the bit vector is all set to 0, okay, which basically goes back to the old x86 model, which says if you have sensitive instructions, ignore them. Okay. But if VT is turned on, you have a virtual machine, then you take all the sensitive instructions in your set, and for those instructions, set all the bits to 1. Okay. At this point, the hardware knows that whenever this VM runs and the OS runs, if any of these instructions are executed, okay, at the user mode, create a trap and let the hypervisor deal with it. Okay, SVM, which is AMD's technology, does something equivalent. Okay, if you have this, now you can go and implement type 1 virtualization. Okay? Yes, there's a question.
Couldn't you also implement type 1 virtualization if just every instruction is to pass through the hypervisor? So it'd be kind of like its own little operating system.
Yes, it's going to cost, that's what emulation does. Huge performance hit. Right? So all native instruction that could execute as is, you only want this trap to occur when you implement sensitive. That a user mode you are executing something that's not sensitive, you don't want any slowdown. You want to run at full native speed. Okay? So that's what happens here. So if there are no sensitive instruction, you are running at the speed of the processor. No performance impact whatsoever. When you execute sensitive instruction, you will take a trap and the hypervisor will do it. That's okay. Then you can take that performance hit. So yes, you can do that, but that's what emulation would do. You'll see slowdown. That's all a performance. Sorry?
It's emulation without translation.
Yes. I think the emulation part is not the part where there's a slowdown. It's the trap or sort of the part where you're doing examination of that instruction that causes the slowdown. Okay, so that's basically what is type 1 hypervisor. This is the picture here. Okay, this is a hardware, this type 1 hypervisor, that's a VM, the guest operating system here. Okay, and there are processes. Okay, so this basically runs in what is called virtual user mode. This is running in virtual kernel mode, or if you have multiple rings, you can run this guest operating system in ring 1. Okay, more privileged than ring 3, but less privileged than ring 0, which is your kernel mode. Okay, so you can actually use ring 1 in x86 to run your guest operating system. Okay, user processes do what they do always. Okay, whenever the guest operating system makes a sensitive instruction, you are going to will privilege one, will cause a trap. Okay, and the hypervisor will take care of it for you. Okay, and then you will go back to the OS and do what you are doing. Okay, so in some sense, what has happened is the hypervisor is now behaving exactly what the kernel was doing for you. Okay. So the hypervisor is the real kernel. To the hypervisor, this just looks like a process that is occasionally trapping to it. Just as for a normal kernel, you have processes that call system calls and occasionally trap to you. That's what's happening here. The guest OS is basically behaving like an application. Because it doesn't have full privileges on this machine, you have to ask the hypervisor to do something for you. In a normal machine, you have full privileges, so you can do everything that the process wants you to do. In this case, a process makes system call to the guest OS traps to the hypervisor actually does the hard work, okay, and then goes back. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So that's type 1 hypervisors. Okay, now let's look at type 2 hypervisors. And as let's go back to the picture here. So in type 2 hypervisors, you already have a host operating system. You are running as a user level process. Okay, you are not running on bare metal. You have a kernel and you are running as a user level process here. Okay. And then there's a guest OS running in the VM that's running on the type 2 hypervisor. Okay. Now how do things work here? Okay. Clearly this guest OS, now this host OS is the one that's going to run in kernel mode. Okay, that should be clear because everything on this host OS looks like normal processes. So here type 2 hypervisor is actually running in user mode. Type 1 hypervisor is running in kernel mode. So this looks like a normal process. Okay. And here is another kernel that thinks it can do privilege instructions or sensitive instructions. But everything above the guest OS, or rather not guest, but host OS, they're all running in user mode. And yet you want privilege instructions to work and whatnot. Okay, so how should this work? So here is what happens. So the way this works is you actually have to go and do some extra work before the process runs. Okay? So you start up, let's say, your guest operating system kernel. Okay? So what happens is you actually go and start scanning all the instructions in this application. Okay? And every time you see a sensitive instruction, you go and replace it on in the binary with a function call. Okay? Because you cannot execute it. The hypervisor itself is running in user mode and the kernel is also running in user mode. So neither of them can execute privilege instruction. Okay? So what you go and do is you scan all the code, okay, the instructions. Can you look for insensitive instructions, replace them by function calls. Okay? On the fly. This is done transparently. You don't have to recompile anything. Okay? You just run and you just scan these and you replace them by function calls. So now what happens is when this guest OS tries to execute what was originally the sensitive instruction, it is basically making a function call. Okay? This function call actually comes to the hypervisor. Okay? And there are different function calls for different instructions. So the hypervisor knows what the guest OS is trying to do. Okay? So then this function call actually triggers a system call to the kernel. Okay? And the kernel can do whatever the guest OS wanted to do for you. Okay. Is this clear how things work? So you don't need any hardware support. Okay. This will run on old, unlike here, this type 1 hypervisor don't even run on old x86 architectures where you don't have VTA support. Here you don't need to do anything to the hardware because what you have done is you have taken everything that was privileged, make them function calls, and then rather than causing traps or whatnot, just make a function call to the hypervisor. Hypervisor says, okay, guest OS wants to do this, it wants to go change the page tables, make a system call, do whatever is needed, and you're done. Yes, question there.
Couldn't the type 1 hypervisor also do that if there was no VT support?
Could the type 1 hypervisor also go and replace instructions? Yes, that's called paravirtualization. That's exactly what I said by paravirtualization. So if you want to implement type 1 hypervisors on old hardware, the only way you do it is you go modify the OS. Okay, and that's called paravirtualization. So I'll come back to that in just a moment. Okay, so this is binary translation. On the fly, you actually look for sensitive instruction, you replace them with native procedures that will basically do the work for you. Okay. So this says, as I said, you can work without VT support. Basically all your sensitive stuff have just become function calls. Function calls go to the hypervisor. Hypervisor does make system calls. Okay. Done. Okay. So paravirtualization, that's what you are asking. Say, why would you not want to do this in type 1 hypervisor? So it turns out that people have done it. Okay. Only difference is that people have done it at compile time, not at runtime. Okay, type 2 hypervisors go and scans for sensitive instructions on the fly and it replaces them with function calls. Okay? And this will have a performance slowdown, as you can imagine, because before you execute any instructions, you have to go scan them. Okay? And find all the instructions that you care about and replace them with function calls. So you will get a performance slowdown. Okay? Now if you want to do this on type 1 hypervisor but not get a performance slowdown, then you do the same thing. when a program or a human does this, not a piece of code. Okay? So human sits and basically says, okay, let me look at the Linux kernel. Okay? Where are all the sensitive instructions in this kernel? Okay? You go and replace them with function calls. Okay? And you compile this new kernel. Okay? New kernel is exactly what type 1, 2 hypervisor did. Except that you are not scanning and replacing, some person has actually done this. Okay? Here there is no performance slowdown because you have done this at compile time and the code that you are executing is what you would have executed in type 2 hypervisor post translation. Okay? That's exactly what paravirtualization does. Okay? As I said, the difference here is you have to go and modify the kernel. Things are no longer unmodified. Okay? In both type 1 and type 2 hypervisor, the application, the OS, everything was unmodified. Okay? For performance reasons, you actually went and modified the kernel and did what type 2 hypervisor did, just change all the sensitive instructions to what are called hyper calls. Okay? So again, same thing, this is modified kernel, modified Linux, okay? And every time you do rather than doing a sensitive instruction, you would make a hyper call, go to the kernel, or rather not the kernel, the hypervisor. Hypervisor does all of the interesting stuff for you. Okay? So you could do this on the fly as well, okay? Just as type 2 hypervisors do, but as I said, to prevent this performance slowdown, okay, people actually went and modified certain operating systems like Linux. Okay? So if you want to run Linux on a paravirtualized thing, you get special versions of Linux that are pre-modified. And there are not a whole lot of places you have to make changes to. Fairly small, okay, but you have to run this modified version, not the old version. And then you can run on old hardware. Doesn't matter, because once you have done this, you don't need any hardware support. Okay, because there are no longer any sensitive instructions in your kernel. All of them have been replaced by procedure calls. In this particular case, they are hyper calls. Okay, next question.
When you are running a type of hypervisor,
Type 2?
So, what the host OS does with all other processes, how it manages virtual memory and all that is, it allocates this block and gives it from that. But now, since the hypervisor has an OS running on top of it, and that thing is running so many applications, if you want it to run normally,
right. So what would happen typically is when you create a virtual machine, this hypervisor will allocate some RAM. Okay? The way it does that is goes to the host OS and say, I want so much memory. Okay? You take that and you allocate this to this VM, okay, through the hypervisor. Okay? It's only a fraction of the RAM on the actual machine. So then the guest OS can take that RAM and it can manage it through the hypervisor, because the RAM addresses are all remapped, because here you have to expose a RAM that goes from byte offset 0 to byte offset n. What is allocated to you may not be all that, so all the translation is happening here. Okay? But you get a piece of memory that logically looks like real RAM starting at address 0, and so all that translation is done here. Okay? But yes, I mean, you are sharing resources on the underlying host operating system. Okay, you look like a process, you are given a certain amount of RAM, you are given a certain amount of CPU, and there are other processes that may be competing with you. Okay, all that is fine. I mean, so long as you are willing to live with all of this performance hit, you can then still get the advantage of running this on unmodified hardware and whatnot.
I mean, taking an example, suppose you run Fusion itself, it doesn't become so slow that you are noticing the performance. Like, it is slow compared to but it still manages it pretty well.
Yeah, that's because the underlying processors have become fast enough that even with this performance hit, things are manageable, right? You have a 2 GHz processor, to this it may look like a 700 MHz processor, 50% slowdown. That's still not bad. Things run and this was just 3 or 4 years old, you had 700 MHz processor and that was state of the art. So you get this hit, but this, because the hardware has improved to a point, this hit does not make noticeable difference. Okay, any other questions here on type 2 hypervisors or paravirtualization? Okay. Alright, so this is slide actually is slightly orthogonal slide. All this slide is saying is there are different types of platforms available. Okay. There's VMware, there is Xen, and there is Parallels and whatnot. Each of them basically uses its own interface and whatnot. So if you create a virtual machine on using one platform, you can't really run it on another platform. So what this is saying, which is also an effort that's ongoing in sort of the industry, is why not basically take the virtual machine to hardware interface library that's used by the virtual machine and standardize it. Okay. So because these are all different interfaces, there's a hypervisor call here, there's a hypervisor, these are sensitive instruction. If you actually replace this by a layer that will handle it for you, then you can take different platforms and different virtual machines and run them without having to do translation of formats and whatnot. Okay. Because as the number of virtual machine platforms grow, then if you get a virtual machine, then you are restricted to running it using that piece of software. So if I get a VMware appliance, and we'll talk about appliances shortly, you have to run it using VMware, the VMware players. You can't run it using Xen or something else. Okay? So this is trying to separate the connection between a virtual machine and what platform it runs on. Okay? Just as you can take Windows and it runs on Intel as well as AMD machines, okay? Because the instruction set is standardized, that's the reason it runs. But you can't take a virtual machine and run it on different platforms. So they are trying to do the same thing that you have get when you have this nice standardized interface, okay? So that's basically, and that is called a virtual machine interface itself. So if you standardize that, then what you run on doesn't matter anymore. Okay. So with that said, let me talk a little bit about memory and I/O virtualization. Okay. So thus far, I actually didn't talk about how devices are virtualized. I only talked about CPU, okay, instruction sets and whatnot. But you have to do the same similar stuff at the memory level for disks, network, and so on. I'm not going to talk about network, but memory and I/O I'll talk a little bit about. Okay. So again, what happens in memory virtualization is the OS that's running inside the virtual machine manages page tables, okay, and it has to muck around with page tables. As new processes start, new page tables have to be allocated and whatnot. Okay. And these are sensitive instructions. Okay. You can't change page table mappings without actually being in privileged mode. Those are privileged instructions. Okay. This causes you to trap to the hypervisor. Okay. And the hypervisor has to deal with the rest. Okay. Now, how do you do this? So what the hypervisor does is, if you want to create a new page table, it will create one called a shadow page table. Okay? So it's one more level of indirection. The hypervisor has what's called a shadow page table. The OS has what's called a real page table. And these are basically mirror images of one another. Okay? Whenever this is modified, you have to somehow go and actually modify this, and then the changes are reflected back. Okay? So how is this done? There are two ways to do it. Okay? So whenever the OS is trying to modify a page table, the hypervisor has to actually go and modify it. So there are two ways to do this. One is, you take the page table that the OS has and you mark it read only. Okay, this is basically a piece of memory at the end of the day. Okay, if you mark that page read only, the OS goes and tries to write to it, okay, that is going to cause a trap, because you are basically trying to write to a read only page. Okay, this trap is going to come back to the hypervisor. Okay. Since the hypervisor knows that this page, actually memory page, has a page table in it, it knows that the OS was trying to modify it. Okay? So then you take the trap and you actually, that, or in this case it may cause a page fault, which is basically a trap, then you go and modify the page table. So this is how you can allow an OS to modify the page table, but then trap to the hypervisor whenever this sensitive instruction or sensitive operation is being carried out. Okay? That's one way to do it. The other way to do it is, you para-virtualize it. Okay? Take all the instructions in the kernel where it is trying to modify the page table, and you replace them with hypercalls. Okay? So when the OS says, I want to change this entry in the page table, okay, it will basically result in the hypercall, goes to the hypervisor, hypervisor performs this privileged operation, and you go back to the OS. Okay? So these are two techniques that are used to virtualize memory. The basic problem to keep in mind is virtualizing memory involves executing certain sensitive or privileged operation. In either case, you want to trap to the hypervisor. So there are two ways here. Okay? This is a hack. Basically, it says, I will make it read only and artificially cause a trap. And this one requires modification to the OS. Okay? If you are running type 1, you do this. If you are doing para-virtualized, you do that. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so last point about virtualization is IO virtualization. So here the question is, what do you do about disk? We talked a lot about CPU. We talked a little bit about memory. There is also disk and networks. Okay, so how would you go about handling disk? Okay. Now again, if you are a kernel, you assume that you have control over the disk. Okay, you can read and write wherever you want. This is how a normal kernel behaves. Okay. If you are running virtualization, then your kernel is effectively a non-privileged process. It's either running in ring 1 or in user mode. Okay. And yet you want to allow this kernel to do I/O on behalf of its application. If some application wants to write a file, the OS has to do it for it. Okay. And if it wants to read, it has to do the same thing. But these are, again, reading and writing files requires disk operation, disk I/O, which are privileged operations. Okay. So how would you go about doing that? Okay. One way is you have to, again, whenever you do any I/O, somehow take a trap to the hypervisor, and the hypervisor takes care of the I/O for you. This is the way you handle memory. Okay. That's one way. There's another way which avoids the need to do any privileged operation altogether. Okay. And the way this is handled is using the notion of a virtual disk instead of real disk. So what happens in virtual disk is you basically take a disk. This is a physical disk drive. Okay. And you can partition it into large empty files. Let's say there are two empty files that you created on this disk, file 1 and file 2. We will call this file a virtual disk. Okay. And this is your hypervisor. This is the OS that's running. So what the hypervisor does is gives the illusion of this file actually looking like a disk to this OS. So now when the OS is trying to access this disk, it's actually doing file I/O at this point, because this is not a real disk. It's just a file that is residing on a disk. Okay. The only thing the hypervisor has to do is translation. Because this OS, to this OS, this looks like a logical disk. So it has block numbers and sector numbers and cylinder numbers and all of that. When it tries to access a certain block number, the hypervisor translates it into a certain file offset. Okay. And then just does that operation for you. Okay. Is this clear, what I just said? So rather than doing what we did for memory, which is taking a trap and trying to do some arbitration, you do something slightly different in the case of disk. You take the physical disk and you chop up into some number of virtual disks, or maybe you create a virtual disk that's basically a large file. Okay. And this basically is you give an abstraction of our disk to the OS, but this disk is mapped on to this file. Okay. All disk operations become file operations on the real disk. Okay. It simplifies a lot of what is going on, because you can only access space that is allocated to you. This looks like a normal disk that's isolated from the rest of the storage space on this disk. Okay. You can't go and access the rest of the disk as far as this OS is concerned. Okay. The hypervisor takes care of translation. Okay. The block numbers are converted to file offset for I/O. Okay. This is what actually happens when if you download a virtual machine, okay, which looks like a virtual disk. That's basically a file that's residing on a real disk. Okay? But when you boot the OS, that actually looks like a real disk to the OS. Okay, if you use VMware, you know what I'm saying. You can copy this file to some other machine, boot that there. Yeah. So it basically looks exactly like a disk, so it's portable. Because it's just a file that's moving around. Any questions? Okay. So there are a couple of other things to talk about. I think I've covered all of this, but let me talk about virtual appliances and multi-core. Okay, last thing I'll mention here. So what is a virtual appliance? A virtual appliance is basically a pre-configured virtual machine with the OS and the applications pre-installed on it. Okay. Typically what you would do is you create a blank virtual machine, then you install some OS on it. You can install Windows or Linux, then you install some applications, and then it looks like a normal machine, except that is a virtual machine. Okay. If somebody gives you a virtual machine that already has an OS and application pre-installed on it, you have what is called an appliance. Okay. So appliance is basically a pre-configured OS and application. Okay. And this has become a popular way to distribute complex applications or to distribute demo versions of normal applications. So if I have a complex application that I have downloaded, usually there's a learning curve. I need to install it. There are a whole set of configuration files. I need to go and start understanding what the configuration parameters are, how to set them, and so on and so forth. Okay. To eliminate this learning curve, somebody can actually configure a virtual appliance, install some OS, install this application, configure it in a certain reasonable way, and distribute it. So all you have to do to run this application is to download this appliance and start it up. Because the OS is already installed, application is pre-configured, application just starts running. Okay? No need to understand what the parameters are, how to configure them, etc. So as I said, lot of demo versions of applications are distributed in this way. So you want to run a demo version of this app, I don't need to know anything. I run this appliance, I figure out what it does, and then I can throw it away if I'm not interested in it anymore. Okay, complex applications, as I said, are also distributed in this way, just to eliminate the learning curve of how to configure and install that. Also to reduce the time it takes you to learn all this. Okay. So if you go, let's say, to VMware's website, right? So there is a, you'll see a link called VMware Marketplace. Okay. You'll find literally thousands of appliances there. Okay. Everything from pre-configured database servers, pre-configured web servers, pre-configured OS distributions. Okay. You can basically get Solaris, for instance, Open Solaris as an appliance. You can download Open Solaris, boot it up, just see what Solaris looks like. You don't need to do anything else. Okay. You can get various flavors of Linux distributions already pre-configured. Okay, you download it, you start it up, you have a Linux machine. Okay, and as well as different applications of various sorts. So that's what appliances are. And the last thing, which is not really directly related to appliance, is the notion of how virtual machines run on multi-core systems. Yeah, this is something I should have mentioned when I talked about CPUs, but nevertheless, let me talk about it here. So now, so just to give you an example, let's go back to this picture here. Let me erase some of this. So let's say you have a hardware. Okay, modern hardware is all multi-core. Okay, so servers in particular may have 4, 8, 16 cores. Let's say the 16 core machine. Okay, it's running type 1 hypervisor. Okay, so you can create some, let's say, 3 VMs. VM1, VM2, VM3. Okay, and the question is, how do you take all of these cores, okay, and partition them across these VMs? There are plenty of cores, so you have to somehow figure out a way to do this. So what you would do is you can say, I assign 4 cores here to this, 4 to this, and the remaining 8 to this. You could basically tell the hypervisor, take 4 of these cores and map this VM onto this core. So whenever this VM runs, these 4 cores are given to us. This, when this VM runs, these other 4 cores, when this one runs, these 8 cores. Okay. Now, it is also possible at the hypervisor level to dynamically vary the number of cores. So, you can say this guy doesn't need 4, so reduce this to 2, and now I'm assigned 6 here. So, you can move this around. Okay. But think of this from a kernel perspective. Okay. I'm a OS kernel that's running in this VM. When I started running, I had 4 cores assigned to me. Suddenly, the number of cores has shrunk to 2. Okay. Most kernels will not be able to handle varying number of processors. They will just crash. Okay. You basically boot with 4 cores, suddenly you have 2 cores, and you have stuff that you assign to the other 2 cores. Not going to run anymore. Okay. Is this clear? Right. I mean, you cannot just vary the number of processors on the kernel on the fly. That's for a kernel that's booted up and running. Okay. So how do you actually deal with the fact that you can take this number actual cores in the machine and move them around? Okay, the way this is done is basically through the notion of virtual CPUs. So as the name suggests, whenever you create a VM, you create some number of virtual CPUs and you allocate it to that VM. Okay, so you can say I want 4 virtual CPUs and you allocate it to this VM. So when this VM boots up, it sees 4 logical processors. 4 cores. Okay? And it's a hypervisor job to somehow map these vCPUs to physical cores. Okay? So if the number of cores actually shrinks from 4 to 2 in particular, let's say each virtual CPU was mapped to a physical core. If the number of actual cores shrinks, then all that the type 1 hypervisor has to do is run these two virtual CPU, map them to a single core, and these two and map them to the other core. Okay. So whenever this vCPU is executing, it runs on this core. Whenever this one, it also runs on this core. So things slow down because you only have two CPUs, half the processing power. But as far as the kernel is concerned, it sees no difference. It sees, still sees its four vCPUs. Only the mapping from vCPUs to physical CPUs has changed. Okay. So by decoupling the notion of a virtual processor and its mapping to physical processors, modern hypervisors actually allow you this flexibility of changing how many cores. You can even assign fractional cores. You can assign half a core to a vCPU. What that means is basically it will take half of the processing cycles and something else will take the other half. Okay. Just looks like a slower version of the physical CPU. So there is a very flexible mapping you can create. Okay. And this is how you can actually deal flexibly with all these multi-core machines. Okay. You can carve out individual cores, assign them to virtual machines. You can change them on the fly without the OS kernel even being aware of it. So it's completely transparent. Only thing that happens is the OS runs either faster or slower depending on how many cores are assigned. You can do the same thing with memory as well. You can take the RAM that is assigned to a virtual machine, change it on the fly. You can take it, make good, increase it from 2 to 4 GB or shrink it. Okay? Again, this has to be done in a way that's transparent to the OS. The OS typically cannot deal with changing memory sizes either. Okay, you can't just say suddenly 2 gig of your RAM is gone. What happens to the processes that were actually loaded in that space? Okay? So to do this, again, there is a trick that you have to play, which is similar to this, which I am not going to go into here, but you have to do something similar. Okay, have this one level of indirection which allows the OS to deal with changing memory sizes. Yes, transparent.
If you have four virtual CPUs that wants to give you more CPU power, what does it do?
More than four cores?
Yeah.
Yeah. You cannot give you, if you have only four vCPUs, you cannot get more than four physical CPUs because there is no way to run one vCPU on two cores. That doesn't make sense. So you have to pick, you have to decide, the only thing you have to decide at VM creation time is what's the maximum number of cores you will ever assign to this process, to this VM. And then you create that many vCPUs. So you can't go above that because there's no, doesn't make sense to have map one vCPUs to two cores.
Right?
Because you cannot run the same processor on two cores. But you can, so you can go up to the number of vCPUs but not more. So that's the restriction that you have. So you have to decide this a priori. So that is indeed a restriction. But if you think of that and you do the right thing ahead of time, saying, okay, I'll never go more than 4 or never go more than 8, that's fine.
What happens if we have top and the CPU and suddenly two more processors are removed, but you still have the same number of applications
running? Right. So there's some question about top and so on. So the processor times that you see in a virtual machine, okay, are not an accurate reflector on the processor time that you actually spend on the physical CPU. Okay. Your top may be showing 100% usage, okay, but that's 100% of what is allocated to you, not 100% of the underlying machine. Okay. So this is something you have to be careful of. What you measure inside a virtual machine does not mean that those resource usage are a reflector of what's happening on the underlying machine. The hypervisor has allocated you something. Of your allocation, top is reporting how much you are using. Because the VM doesn't really know what's happening underneath it. It says, I have this much, I'm using the whole thing. So that's
20%
the
20% the number of processes are reduced by half. Would
that go up for about 40%? Yes, if you decrease the number of vCPUs, your resource utilization will change. Because what's happening has also changed underneath. Okay, so we are going to stop here. Okay, next time we will go back to our discussion on distributed scheduling.